study to the political economy of war, and I put this course together about a year or so ago. I taught it as a 10-week course, but it kind of dragged out. It was the first time I did it. I've also taught a 14-week university course entitled The Political Economy of War, so I'm trying to tailor this for the Meets of the Academy, our format, and what I think students, how much time they're willing to invest in something like this. And there is a great literature in the Austrian school, in Austrian social theory, and libertarian theory, and in history about war. And it's not just the historians who have been writing about war, or the journalists. There's a long history of economists saying a lot about war. And of course, the most prominent of which that I put in the first article on the reading list is Ludwig von Mises. And so what I intend to do is look at just what the course says, the political economy of war. It's not a course on defense economics. There are courses like that at the university level. It's not a course on how to use economics to be more efficient at waging war. It's the analysis of the causes and consequences of war on society using primarily economic reasoning, political philosophy, and understanding of some historical facts also. And that's pretty much what I do in my work and my research and my writing. If anyone wants to have a grade for the course, since it's only a 5-week course, and I usually give exams about every 4 or 5 weeks in my university courses, I think what I'll do is I'll make up one final exam for anyone who wants a grade for the course, and within a day or two after the fifth class, I'll send it to Danny, and he'll administer it. And so if anyone wants a grade, you can take the exam for the grade. He usually gives you, we usually have, 4 or 5 days or a week to get it done online. And also feel free to email me personally. I put my email address up there on the chat group if you have questions at any time, or we can use the course website as far as that goes. But if you have questions about a book or a reading or something like that, feel free to shoot me an email about that. So tonight's class, I put a few readings on the economics of war. And the chapter from Human Action by Ludwig von Mises is a real classic by a very learned man in thinking about war. And my favorite quotation in that whole chapter really summarizes the main point is at the top of page 827 in Human Action. And I thought I might as well read it because it's just packed with knowledge about the economics of war. And just vintage von Mises, too. And here's what he said. He said, "What distinguishes man from animals is the insight into the advantages that can be derived from cooperation under the division of labor. Man curbs his innate instinct of aggression in order to cooperate with other human beings. The more he wants to improve his material well-being, the more he must expand the system of the division of labor. Concomitantly, he must more and more restrict the sphere in which he resorts to military action. The emergence of the international division of labor requires the total abolition of war. Such is the essence of the laissez-faire philosophy of Manchester." And if you have time to do some of the reading, you might have noticed that Arnuzzi refers to the Manchester School in several places. And what the Manchester School was, it wasn't literally a school, for those of you who have never heard of it. In Great Britain, in the early 19th century, around the 1830s or 1840s, there were two men named Cobden and Bright, Richard Cobden and William Bright, and they were libertarians, they were free market economists, and above all else, they were free traders. And they were businessmen, and they and some of their colleagues took it upon themselves to crusade for free trade in Great Britain. And their ideas were based on the ideas of Adam Smith, some of the early Austrians or even pre-Austrians at that time, who the French physiocrats, who were precursors of the Austrian school, and the free market economics of their day. And they were crusaders. They published newspapers. They went all around Great Britain giving speeches, holding public forums. They got themselves and others elected to the legislature, and they succeeded in abolishing all tariffs on imports in England by 1850. And so it wasn't literally a school of thought like the Chicago School or the Austrian School of Economics. It's called the Manchester School. And it's a very important part of classical liberalism. There's a statue of Cobden in London. They were also very instrumental in the slavery abolition movement in England. And England ended slavery in the British Empire about 20 years or so before it was ended in the United States. So that's what Mises is referring to when he refers to the Manchester School. And on this quotation, this really is the essence of the classical liberal view of war and the relationship between war and capitalism or war and the market. And the basic idea is that what holds civilization together, what makes civilization exist, why we don't live like animals in caves, is the international division of labor, in which all human beings can specialize in something, and they work at that something, whether you're a farmer or a business person or a laborer or an engineer or whatever, and you make money doing these things, whether you're in business or working for a business, and you use that money to buy things that you are incapable of providing for yourself from other people who are. Think what life would be if we all had to provide our own food, grow our own food, build our own houses, create our own automobiles, clothe ourselves from scratch. We would live like animals in caves. And so it literally is the international division of labor that holds society together. And what the Manchester School, and which is really the 19th century libertarian movement, was saying is that the broader is the movement toward capitalism, the more that people cooperate under the international division of labor, and the more they discover that they can benefit, they can improve their lives, they can prosper by cooperating with other people, by trading with other people, by getting to know other people by doing this, the less likely there will be war or conflict. Why would you want to shoot your neighbor if you would be literally harming yourself economically? That's what, for example, to bring this up to a contemporary example, some of the war propaganda that's being spouted almost on a daily basis is the claim that the government of Iran wants to cut off somehow the Straits of Hormuz and cut off the oil supply from the Middle East. Now, Iran sells oil. They're in the Middle East. They sell us oil. Why would they want to cut off the Straits of Hormuz and deprive themselves of the ability to sell their oil to other people in the world? Why would they want to impoverish themselves? If you think about this just for a second, you realize how silly it is, but the politicians who stop this this line are banking on the fact that the general public is so ignorant and so unwilling to educate themselves that they won't think about it for more than a minute. And so it's the people who want to interfere with trade with Iran or anybody who are after a war. And so that's the essence of what von Mises was saying here. Is that, and it's the essence of, there's an old saying in classical liberal literature that if goods cannot cross borders, armies will. And Friedrich Bastiat was famous for that saying, that, although I'm not sure if he was the one who coined the saying. And that was certainly true of Europe, because the history of the war in Europe in the 18th and 19th centuries was that governments that engaged in wars of conquest, many of them did so, especially in the late 19th, early 20th century. Governments that did so because they foolishly embarked on some sort of policy of autarky. That's spelled A-U-T-A-R-K-Y, autarky. And what it means is an attempt to be self-sufficient in everything. This was the official economic policy of Nazi Germany, for example. They wanted to be self-sufficient in everything. And of course, in Europe, there are no countries in Europe who have anywhere near the resources that are necessary for everything. There are many parts of Europe, for example, that have a severe water shortage problem. They don't have the mineral richness that America has or that Russia has, for example. And so they must rely on trading with other countries in order to have more, let alone to have everything that they need in terms of food, clothing, shelter, and everything else. And so under the fool's errand of trying to be self-sufficient in everything, a lot of governments soon realized that, well, we cannot do that, but if we were to conquer country X, Y, and Z and so forth, you know, next to us, they do have these resources that we need. And so to get them, we need to enlarge our country. And so that was the source of much war and conflict in history in Europe, especially the foolish idea to shun international trade, to shun the international division of labor, and instead to try to prosper through conquest rather than peaceful cooperation in the international division of labor. Von Mises actually says something similar in the very first sentence of this chapter, where he says, "The market economy involves peaceful cooperation, but it bursts asunder when the citizens turn into warriors and instead of exchanging commodities and services, fight one another." This is an important point because it pinpoints out war is really the opposite of capitalism. Capitalism is peaceful exchange among consenting adults making use of private property system and the free market pricing system. That's what capitalism is. It's not recruiting the government to invade a neighbor in order to get some corporation that can gain financially in the country of the neighbor that was invaded by your government. That's not what capitalism is. War is just the opposite of capitalism. War is death and destruction of the capital stock, the most important ingredient of capitalism. Capitalism is either destroyed or it's put to uses for which consumers have no use at all. Consumers have no use at all for missiles that blow up cities. That's not a consumer good. And so if the capital stock is not literally destroyed in war, what happens is it's diverted to uses that have nothing to do with serving your fellow man in terms of in the way that capitalism does in producing goods and services in return for money. And Von Mises does an interesting overview of history of war in this chapter, where he talks about the early wars in Europe, especially, were really wars among the monarchs. And he mentions the philosopher Grotius, who was famous for probably the first person to write out the law, international law, with regard to warfare. And up to about the time of the American Civil War, around 1860 or so, the international law, which was, by the way, taught at West Point by Henry Halleck. His book, that is, he wrote the book on international law, and his book was used at West Point prior to the Civil War. And he of course, became a U.S. Army general during the Civil War, General Halleck. Codified the idea that, yes, in war, civilians will inevitably be harmed, but it is a war crime to intentionally bomb cities, burn cities, murder civilians, and so forth. And that was the evolution of Europe up to that point, primarily, and America, in terms of the rules of war, if you will, in that it was generally considered to be a moral atrocity to intentionally murder civilians, although, of course, that has always happened in all of human history with regard to war. There's always been plunder and murder involved. But civilization had been moving in the direction of outlawing that and putting criminal penalties attached to that sort of behavior. And in the wars in Europe before that point were mostly the wars between the monarchs. And the monarchs mostly used mercenaries. And because they had paid mercenaries, it placed a limit on war. The limit was the amount of money the king had to pay the mercenaries. And so the citizens were left out of it for the most part. They were rarely touched by wars as far as that goes. And also the aggressiveness of various monarchs was checked by another reason. Not only was it checked by the fact that there was a budget constraint, but if there was one of the monarchs among numerous ones who was excessively aggressive, then of course he would make more and more enemies. And the other monarchs who worried that they might be next would form coalitions against the aggressive one. And so there was sort of an evolutionary natural check on the aggressiveness of some of the monarchs. It did not eliminate aggressiveness, military aggressiveness, but it did place a check on it. And so prior to the French Revolution, wars were fought by relatively small armies. They were mostly mercenary armies. They concerned mostly the rulers and professional soldiers, not the general population. And the citizens generally opposed all wars because the wars benefited the monarchs, and there were never any benefit to them at all. The wars were wars of conquest for the most part. And as a side point about all of these wars of conquest that took place in European history, one of the characteristics of Europe in history was that it was once a place of hundreds of independent city-states. And this was really the seedbed of the idea of federalism that the American founding fathers had and incorporated into the United States Constitution, into the original Constitution. Federalism or states' rights was really the preeminent idea of the original American Constitution. And it comes not only from ideas, but from experience and history in Europe, where they understood that all of these independent city-states at one time provided escape routes from tyranny. If one set of rulers in one particular city-state was oppressive and destructive of freedom and taxed too much, you could go somewhere else. You could, with a relative ease, you could migrate, you could vote with your feet, so-called. But of course, the wars of conquest eventually led to more and more consolidation of governments, so that by today we have a few dozen governments, and we're actually moving, of course, Europe has moved in the direction with the European Union of having sort of a Soviet-style system, you know, not with communism, but, you know, one monopolistic government. So the evolution of this from, you know, 300 or 400 years ago when they had many, many independent city-states to today is that the wars of conquest are the main reasons why there were no longer all the city-states that existed. You know, by the time you get to the 20th century, there were just a few dozen left. But it was the wars of conquest that led to that. So the Manchester Liberals, of course, the liberal in the way that von Mises is talking about is from the root liberty. And that word still in Europe is still used to refer to libertarians generally. But of course, in the United States, a liberal is essentially a socialist. But in the European sense, a liberal is a libertarian. And so he refers to the Manchester Liberals in this chapter. And the Manchester Liberals on the issue of war were advocates of democracy as opposed to monarchy, but also laissez-faire. They were not so naive as to think that democracy alone could put an end to warfare. Democracies do war against each other, contrary to what the neoconservatives will tell us. They've been telling us for quite a long time, and not just the neoconservatives, that democracies don't wage war on each other. But you know, after the French Revolution, when the French monarchy was lost, and they adopted democracy, the French became very belligerent, didn't they, with Napoleon? And so, you know, even ancient history tells us that this is not correct, that democracy is not a guarantee of peace. And of course, in the American experience, when the U.S. government, which was a form of a democracy, invaded the southern states in 1861, the southern states were set up as a similar democracy. Both democracies had slavery in them, although the U.S. government had slavery under the U.S. flag for many, many generations at that point, and the Confederate government was new. But they were both constitutional republics. They used democracy, not dictatorship, not monarchy, and they waged war on each other. And so the idea that democracy is a guarantor of peace is just not in keeping with history, as far as that goes. And the Manchester Liberals understood that democracy is not enough. That they understood that, yes, the wars in Europe were wars of conquest for the most part between monarchs. The democracy is not enough. That's not going to do it. Laissez-faire is also necessary, and free trade is necessary. Because as I said, the cycle that happened would be these governments would adopt economic interventionism, nationalize industry, trade restrictions, tariffs, import quotas, and so forth, and all of these things would be harmful to their own economy and would restrict their ability to prosper. If you put restraints on international trade, you put restraints on the international division of labor and on the ability of people to peacefully cooperate with each other to their mutual benefit. And so when you do that, you impoverish yourself, the governments would respond by what? By conquest. They shut themselves in the foot economically through interventionism, And the consequences of this economic interventionism was impoverishment. And they responded to the impoverishment often by conflict. And so it was interventionism that was the cause of a lot of the war, especially interventionism with trade, impediments in free trade. And so that is why the Manchester liberals thought democracy is never sufficient. You need free trade and laissez-faire also. And so war was in European history, was a result of a kind of aggressive nationalism, where the governments would screw up their own economies with trade restrictions and other economic interventions, and then in the name of the nation, you know, Germany or France or Great Britain, whatever, they would seek conquest. They would always, of course, empires always benefit the people who run the empires first and foremost, and the people are used as tax slaves and cannon fodder for the most part. And so the 19th century, especially, certainly was the century of empire, and empire always benefits the empire builders at the expense of the common ordinary people who are used as conscripts and taxpayers to benefit the empire builders. One difference between Ludwig von Mises and Friedrich Hayek, his student, is that von Mises talked about how things such as the United Nations were futile. Whereas in The Road to Serfdom, Hayek's famous book, The Road to Serfdom, published in 1944, he sort of spoke favorably on such things as the United Nations. He thought they could be useful in helping to deter future wars at that time. But von Mises himself was quite harshly critical of the whole idea. Another important point that von Mises makes here is that he asks the question, does war require socialism? Because we do observe that governments habitually, when they're at war, nationalize industries, commandeer resources, impose price controls, and generally have an explosion of economic interventionism in order to fight the war. Conscription also. It's all a matter of degree, of course. Not every country, not every government nationalizes a lot of industries and goes that route. But that has been the history of most governments in war. And von Mises points out that price controls, especially, are disastrous in wartime. Governments are always eager to impose price controls to hold down the prices of the things they need to buy for the military. But of course, when they do that, they reduce the profitability of the products being produced for the military. And if the price controls are severe enough, they can eliminate the profitability of producing these things, and therefore you won't get those things. In one of my articles on Mises.org, it was published, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago at least, it was called 4,000 Years of Price Control. I cited a book with that title, 4,000 Years of Price Control. It told the story of how George Washington's army, the American Revolution Army, was in Pennsylvania. The state government of Pennsylvania, the state legislature, thought it would help the army by putting price controls on just about everything the army was using. And of course, an army, a big army in the field, is just like a city. The human beings in the army need just about everything that people anywhere would need: food, clothing, and shelter. And so they placed pervasive price controls, and George Washington's army nearly starved and froze to death in the field in Pennsylvania because of this, because there were shortages of everything immediately. But luckily for George Washington and his army, that the Pennsylvania legislature and Continental Congress understood what was happening. They understood that the price controls were the problem, so the Continental Congress issued a proclamation that this should be put to an end immediately, and the Pennsylvania politicians did, and everything almost magically sprung up out of nowhere, because it was once again profitable to sell all these items to the army, to George Washington's army. And so and that's a point that Mises hits on in this chapter, that price controls especially can be disastrous at wartime. When he talks about socialism, he talks about government control of the means of production. Well, price control is one way in which governments control the means of production in wartime. And And he also makes this point. He says, and I'm quoting, that war and the preservation of the market economy are incompatible. And what he means here is that he doesn't mean that governments will always inevitably adopt some kind of socialism when they're at war. He's saying that capitalism is so good at producing goods and services that if you're in war and you're in war in a long enough period of time, that capitalism can produce weapons that can be so destructive that they can destroy the whole world. And of course, he's writing this many decades ago, but he must have had in mind nuclear weapons that he was talking about. Capitalism is too good at producing weapons. And so you can produce weapons that can destroy the entire infrastructure of a country. And of course, we are very, very easily able to do that today. The U.S. government destroyed the water and sewage treatment infrastructure of Iraq in the early 90s, for example, which is why Madeleine Albright, the former U.N. secretary, made the famous statement when asked what she thought of the fact that depriving Iraq of chlorine and other elements of clean water for 10 years led to 500,000 deaths of children. She said that was a price we were willing to pay, and gave a lot of terrorists some ideas when she said that. That's just one small example of how the weapons produced by capitalism are able to destroy an entire country, an entire civilization, if they want to. That's what von Mises was talking about. And he of course, also hits on the folly of autarky, of governments during the 20th century that pursued the silly policy of independence in just about everything. And tried to stay away from the international division of labor. And so it was nationalism in Mises' day that he thought was a major cause of war, and nationalism combined with interventionism. And he also has a very interesting take on European history that I haven't mentioned yet, about he recognizes that there are scarce natural resources. And so autarky was always impossible in Europe, as far as that goes. And so all the countries were always dependent on international trade. But what they did was they attempted interventionism, economic interventionism, socialism of one kind, interventionism of one kind. And that, of course, is the opposite of entrepreneurship and free markets. And so they impoverished themselves that way through interventionism. And that is what led to trouble. That's what leads to the trouble of militarism, self-inflicted economic suicide, if you will. And now on another issue, another big issue on the economics of war is the broken window fallacy. And some of you probably are well aware of what the broken window fallacy is. It's really an application of the economic notion of opportunity cost. And it really explains why war can never generate prosperity. War can generate profit for some people. The war profiteers, the people who sell the governments, the military apparatus, they of course benefit very nicely. But it comes at the expense of all the other things that money could have been used for. So the idea that war is good for the economy is on par with in terms of silliness, with the idea that hurricanes or floods or earthquakes or fires that burn down entire cities are good for the economy. Of course, if a fire burned down an entire city, yes, we would see a lot of job creation in the building industry, the rebuilding industry, but what we don't see is what all those resources would have been used for alternatively had they been not used to rebuild the city. And the same is true with war. When we go to war, even a defensive war or a just war that is necessary, it's one thing to say it's a just war because we're defending ourselves against an aggressor, but we shouldn't delude ourselves into thinking that it will make us rich, that it will enrich us, because all the resources, all the capital that would have been used to produce goods and services to make our lives as civilians better are diverted instead to killing and destroying things and people somewhere else. And so war is never good for prosperity. In fact, war, like all government programs, today is bad for prosperity. It diverts resources away from the sector of private property, free enterprise, and entrepreneurship. That's what creates wealth. That's what creates prosperity. That's what creates jobs. It's not the diversion of money and resources to any government program. And war is a government program, after all. And a lot of people don't understand this. Probably the one person who has the hardest time of anyone understanding this is Paul Krugman of the New York Times. I call him Paul, government can never spend enough of your money, Krugman. Every once in a while, he does say things like, one good thing about the war in Iraq, war in Afghanistan, or the upcoming war is a good boost to the economy. And of course, he doesn't understand the concept of opportunity cost, which I teach to my freshman students in week one of my principles of microeconomics class. The Krugman has never been able to understand that. Now, in the context of what I said earlier about von Mises' elaboration of the history of Europe and the monarchs and how the wars in European history were relatively small because there was a budget constraint. And the budget constraint was the money, the gold that the monarch had to have to use to pay the mercenaries. Of course, central banking changes all of that. Once the governments gave themselves the ability to print money, then there no longer were any restraints, any budget restraints on waging war. In one of the classes in a couple of weeks, I devoted toward the whole subject of the effects of printing of money on war and how it essentially hides or disguises the costs of war to the public. And so that's one way in which some people do think that the government can give us something for nothing. They can give us war for nothing at no cost if they're not directly taxed for it. And so, but that doesn't excuse why someone like Paul Krugman, who has a PhD in economics from MIT, does not understand this and thinks there is something for nothing. And of course, even if war or any other government program is financed by money printing, the money printing may cause price inflation, it may cause boom and bust cycles in parts of the economy, bubbles, and the bubbles ultimately burst, so it will cause a depression in part of all of the economy. And even if it doesn't do that, or if it doesn't do that for several years, it does enable politicians to divert resources to their use, to their control, from the control of those resources, labor, materials, and so forth, by private entrepreneurs, private households, private individuals. And so it doesn't matter if we see the results of financing a war now, today, immediately. If you study economics, you will understand that these do occur, that there is no free lunch. If government uses more resources for war, by definition, there are fewer real resources available for us to do on other things. And another article I put on the reading list was one by Robert Higgs on wartime prosperity. And this is a good example of how even mainstream economists, for the most part, don't understand the principle of opportunity cost. It's probably because of the fuzzy-headedness of Keynesian economics. So many of them have been trained in macroeconomics, which I don't really consider to be economics at all, but sort of a version of half-baked engineering, where they just have, you have to ignore real economics to be a macroeconomist, it would seem. But the standard story that is told by a lot of people, about the majority of economics professionals will say this. Some of the books do. The World War II finally ended the Great Depression. And certainly a lot of non-economists will say this and believe this. In one of my books, in my book, How Capitalism Saved America, I quote Newt Gingrich as saying that Franklin Roosevelt was one of the greatest figures in all American history because he got America out of the Great Depression, and he was referring to the war, of course. And so what did happen during World War II is, the so-called New Deal, which began in 1933, and was really an extension of Herbert Hoover's economic policies, and an elaboration of them, had failed. The unemployment rate was still in the 17-18% range in the late 30s. By the time we get to 1940, I think it was still that range. And so despite all of Franklin Roosevelt's efforts, unemployment was still about five times what it was in 1929, on the eve of the Great Depression. And so unemployment is still 14, 15, 16% according to the official government statistics, or higher. Then World War II comes along, and the official statistics show that unemployment pretty much disappeared. It went from, in 1940, the official government statistic was unemployment was 14.6%, about 14.5%. By 1944, the government was telling us that the unemployment rate was 1.2%. And most of those people in the 1.2% of the labor force were probably people who were between jobs looking for something better. So the people, the number of people who were involuntarily unemployed were pretty close to zero in 1944. And so the Keynesian economists especially have long heralded this as proof that Keynesian economics works. That is, the government can spend money to get us out of a recession or a depression. And of course, the big question has always been, where will the money come from? And of course, look in the mirror and you will find the answer to the question, where will the money come from? And of course, what really happened was, let's see if I can get the right numbers here, was that the unemployment from 1940 to 1944, the number of people who were unemployed fell by 7.45 million. That is, there were 7.45 million people out of work in 1940 who were no longer out of work by 1944. However, the armed forces were increased by 10.87 million, call it 11 million. So you have about 7.5 million people out of work, and through conscription or through joining the army, a lot of people have joined the army. Hundreds of thousands of men joined the military because they understood that if you joined as opposed to being drafted, you were less likely to be in the infantry. And so as a result, you know, a lot of these men who did join didn't really join voluntarily. They knew they were going to be drafted, so they joined hoping they would get a better assignment, less dangerous assignment once they were in. And so it's no secret that if the military conscripts and otherwise sends 11 million men to war, and 7.5 million of them have been previously unemployed, well, yes, you're going to eliminate unemployment. But a man with a job who comes home in the evening and has dinner with his family is not the same as a man with a job in the military who sits in a foxhole in Belgium in the wintertime and gets his arms and legs blown up. It's not quite the same. The Keynesian economists assume that it's the same, but it's not. It's a much more dangerous job. You're paid slave wages. You're forced to endure great hardships, great danger. You may die or come back with body parts missing and be maimed for life. It's not the same thing at all. And so World War II did not end the Great Depression. And also, Higgs has some statistics on consumption expenditures. Private consumption expenditures fell during the war because resources were diverted from consumer use to the military use. So the standard of living for the consumers back at home actually got worse during World War II, not better. So under any measure, unemployment, consumer spending, etc., things were worse during the war for the domestic economy than they were before the war. So not only did the World War II not end the Great Depression, it actually made it worse. It actually made the economy worse here at home. You know, whether or not the war was just is a different question, but it didn't get the economy out of the Great Depression. Another deleterious effect of the war that Higgs writes about, and which I put on the reading list, is the effects on capital consumption. And you know, one of the key differences between the Keynesian school of economics and the Austrians is the Austrians place a greater emphasis on capital accumulation as being a prerequisite for economic growth and prosperity. You have to save now or defer consumption today, save for the future. The savings provides financial capital for borrowing by businesses and individuals, and that additional borrowing creates capital goods, and the capital goods are the source of the production of goods and services that are the source of our prosperity in the future, of our increased standard of living. And so during the war, this capital investment is taken away. It's taken away. It's used for the military. It's not used for the consumer sector. And so during World War II, net private domestic investment, an investment by businesses minus depreciation, fell from $9.1 billion in 1941 to $0.3 billion in 1942. And then it was negative. In the next 3 years, it was negative $4.1 billion, negative $2.9 billion, and negative $0.2 billion. And so overall, the net private investment was negative. And so it's capital that fuels capital investment and which creates capitalism. And so during the war, the capital for capitalism actually was negative. It was negative net investment by about $3 or $3.5 billion overall during the war. And so what that means is that the entire U.S. economy was set back for many, many years after the war, because you could never recover that lost capital investment. The capital investment certainly picked up after the war ended, but you can never recover what was lost. You know, even if you assume it was a just war, the American intervention of the war was a just war, that's a different issue. The issue we're talking about here is the effect of the war on the economy, and the effect is all bad. It's bad for consumer spending, it's bad for investment spending, it's bad for capital accumulation, and also there was rationing. You know, and so a lot of the goods that were supplied to consumers at home during World War II were allocated by political means, and that always leads to a lot of bribery and so forth. And so the markets that did exist were not real markets. They were politically manipulated markets during World War II. And so, and of course, we're going to talk a little more about how the wars were prosecuted. But generally, in World War I and World War II, the government did nationalize a number of industries. It did impose all sorts of price controls of all sorts. In some industries, price controls were pushed below market prices, which caused severe shortages. But in other industries, they developed a cozy relationship between defense contractors and the government, where they paid too much. The prices were set by government, and they were set at high prices. And so there was a massive misallocation of resources. Markets weren't allowed to work during World War II. And the same thing happened during World War I. And that's what Bogdanovich was referring to when he criticized price controls. It mucks up the economy. It makes each rational economic calculation becomes impossible if government determines the prices, because the prices do not reflect scarcity of resources. They do not reflect the intensity of consumer demand. They're arbitrary. And so it makes rational economic calculation becomes arbitrary, and that's not good for the economy. And it actually harms the war effort. The country would have been much better off relying on the U.S. would have been relying on the free market. And so that's another very important point here that Bob Higgs makes in his article about capital accumulation. And so I guess the important part of this latter discussion here is all about the broken window fallacy for the most part, and that you shouldn't be fooled into thinking that war can create prosperity. It can create prosperity for some, but only for some by imposing costs and burdens on others. And also it's the soldiers who always bear the greatest burden, because the soldier pays taxes like everybody else, and if he or she is lucky enough to come back alive, the soldier will end up paying higher taxes for the rest of his life to pay off his share of all the debt that was accumulated to finance the war. And of course, soldiers are much more disproportionately likely to be harmed or killed in the war. So if they're not killed or maimed for life or given some sort of physical or mental disease and problems by the war, they still have to pay higher taxes than everybody else. And so they make the biggest sacrifice participating in the war, and then when they come home, they make bigger sacrifices yet for the most part. And so it's the soldiers that actually bear the biggest burden of any war, financially speaking, that is. And Mises makes this point also in his discussion here. And I see here, and it's about 8:15, and the format that I like to use, it's the night class, and I know I've been teaching, I've taught night classes for many years at the university, and I know no one likes to sit through more than about a 45-minute lecture. And then I usually like to have Q&A, and if we have questions, we can have questions tonight on the chat, or there's a Q&A, and I'll just look over the chat area here, and also the Q&A to see what you all have been chatting about. And if you have questions, just write questions in, and I'll do my best to answer whatever questions you might have. See if I can find a question here in the chat. A lot of chat. Well, let's see. Tara's asking, what is the book Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt, which is online, and the chapter called The Broken Window Fountain, The Broken Window. Tara is asking about that. Read the chapter called The Broken Window. And there's a great little YouTube video called The Broken Window also that some students who attended Mises University several years ago made. They went back home and they made a really neat little video called The Broken Window. And so you can read the chapter online for free, The Broken Window, and look at the video on YouTube also. It's Henry Hazlitt, Hazlitt. Yeah, Friedrich Bastiat explained it originally, but Henry Hazlitt was his American, what they call him, an interpreter, but he was an expositor of a lot of the ideas that Bastiat popularized in the 1840s. Bastiat's essay, it's an essay entitled What is Seen and What is Not Seen. It's online. The Foundation for Economic Education, and I know they have it on their website, fee.org. If you were just Google what is seen and what is not seen by Bastiat, I'm sure you'll find it. It's a great essay. If I were to put together just principles of economics in a class, if somebody says, I know next to nothing about economics, where should I start? The essay, What is Seen and What is Not Seen, would be in the first week, along with The Broken Window by Henry Hazlitt and all of Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt, for that, as far as that's concerned. And there's the YouTube there, I see. Here's the link for the YouTube. Tara is asking, would you say that the majority of wars are simply for conquest? Well, wars are complicated things. I don't think I would say all wars are for conquest necessarily, but there's a long history of conquest. There's actually a conquest theory of the state that goes back hundreds of years. There's a famous book called The State by Franz Oppenheimer, and I would, if you're really, really interested in digging into this, read The State by Franz Oppenheimer. Oppenheimer was a German sociologist who studied the history of conquest and the history of the formation of states. And his work came to be known as the conquest theory of the state, where he said that he argued that all throughout history, if you look at anthropological research and historical research, that states were created by one gang, essentially, conquering the neighboring gang and declaring itself king or whatever, monarch. And that's always been the history of states, how states were formed. And so if you're talking about the sweep of history, certainly conquest has been the overwhelming cause of it. Well, if you look at the American Civil War, though, I guess you could call that a war of conquest, but the southern states said they had a right to secede from the Union, Abraham Lincoln and the Republican Party said, no, under the American system, under no circumstances can any citizen at any time leave for any reason. Secession was illegal, flat out illegal under any circumstances. And they believe that that gave them the right to wage total war on any individuals or groups of individuals who wanted to leave the Union. And so saving the Union was the reason they gave for waging the Civil War. It was the reason Abraham Lincoln gave, it's the reason the U.S. Congress gave. And so that wasn't really conquest. It's not as though, although they did conquer the South and exploit it for 10 years during Reconstruction, but then the U.S. Army eventually left, and it wasn't really a war of conquest in the sense that the European wars of conquest were over the ages. Let's see, Andrew wants to know how Robert Higgins' reassessment was received by the profession. Well, it was received in the same way that a lot of what Bob Higgs or myself does is like the skunk at the garden party. So there are a lot of people who have invested a lot of capital, human capital, in the false idea that World War II ended the Great Depression. And so when you have somebody who comes along with ironclad logic and facts that disputes that, their first reaction is to ignore it. But a lot of the younger people in the profession and outside of the economics profession have not ignored it. And there are a lot of free market economists out there, hundreds, many hundreds, who are not necessarily Austrian economists, but Chicago school type economists also, which is similar to, they also are known to be sympathetic to the market. That admire Bob Higgins' research and are persuaded by it and understand this. And so it has had a significant impact, and it gives us ammunition. It gives all of us ammunition, you know, his hard work and his logic and his facts. Our Enemy of the State by Albert J. Nock also references Oppenheimer, Franz Oppenheimer's work. Let's see, the question here by Matthew Gilliland about what one of the things Mises said is that in ancient history, the primitive tribes did not affect cooperation under the division of labor. Well, that's true if there wasn't any cooperation under the division of labor. In primitive tribes, were just tribes who were nomads that lived off the land by themselves and did not interact with other people. Well, then the wars between the tribes did not affect the international division of labor because there was no international division of labor. But once society developed a little more deeply than that, then wars did interfere with the division of labor. I think it does strengthen Mises' case for that, in answering that question. Let's see, is there anything under the Q&A here? Let's see, it's a question. Tom Wood logged the boom of 1946, and rightly so, but I read today that inflation was pretty awful then. No, the boom was not a Bernanke-like event. It's not just Tom Woods. Tom Woods is just repeating Robert Higgins' research. In 1946, the federal government budget declined from about $95 billion for the B to around $35 billion for the B from 1945 to 1947 because of the demilitarization at the end of World War II. And so, in an absolute sense, there was a two-thirds reduction in federal government spending. That's what created the boom of 1946. And Robert Higgins' point has pointed out in some of his research that the year 1946 was the biggest increase in private sector economic growth in all of American history. There was an explosion of economic growth that coincided with a massive reduction in government spending by two-thirds. In 1946, And they gave me the compliment, I think it's all wrong, because in their calculation of gross national product, they include government spending. And so they subtract out from the economy the $65 billion or so that was government spending that went back in the pockets of the people. It was no longer being spent on the military. But if you look at private consumption and private investment, it was the biggest one-year increase in all of American history, and it wasn't a phony baloney bubble created by the Fed. Just the opposite. It was created by massive, massive reduction by two-thirds in absolute dollars in government spending, which is exactly what we need to do today. Could I further discuss the crowding out effect of wartime spending? Well, every dollar the government spends on anything means the government, that those resources, land, labor, materials, natural resources, whatever, is being directed by politicians. And the whims of politicians and bureaucrats are deciding how those resources are to be used, whether it's war or any other government program. And so they necessarily divert all those resources from being directed by private individuals, but ultimately by consumers. That's who calls the shots, really, in the market economy, the consumer, and entrepreneurs, and the capital markets, and so forth. And so all wartime spending diverts all those resources necessarily from one area to another, from the private sector to the government sector, as does all government spending, not just war spending, but also government spending. And so, and you don't have to say that's a bad thing either. I mean, that's straight economics. And that says nothing about whether it's a good thing or a bad thing to divert spending from the private sector to the government sector. It simply says this is a fact. And the crowding out occurs because all the people who were drafted in the military in World War II, for example, could not have been back at home working at peacetime jobs. No, gridlock is always a good thing. Keith is asking, should he be bothered by gridlock? Of course not. What you should be bothered by is the absence of gridlock in Congress. There's an old saying that no man is safe while the legislature is in session. That's certainly true. There's another old saying that the two-party system in Washington consists of the stupid party and the evil party. And what bipartisanship is when they do something that is both stupid and evil. And so if gridlock stops them from doing stupid and evil things, well, that's a good thing. And so, if you want more prosperity and more peace, you need less government, not more government for that. And so gridlock is always a good thing. Although the media, which are just kept puppies of the Washington establishment, with maybe one or two exceptions, I certainly will not include Rush Limbaugh as an exception to that. He's as much of a kept puppy of the Republican Party as anybody is of any party. They support this idea that gridlock is bad. We need more laws, more tax, more spending. Let's see. States' rights and an extension of the sorts of the old monarchy self-checking each other. I'm not sure that's the question. Mike wants to know, was our revolution a conquest of the loyalists? They were conquered, weren't they? The revolution was a war of secession from the British Empire. It wasn't a war of conquest in that George Washington wanted to rule over London. He did not want to run the government in London. It was a war of secession in which we seceded from the British Empire. And so I wouldn't call it a conquest, I would call it a war of secession. The first war of secession in America. First American war of secession would be an accurate term, I think. Now let me see if there's anything in the chat here that I need to be looking at. If Jeff Lustigar is surprised that none of the other Republicans have moved toward Ron Paul's anti-war positions. By the way, Ron Paul is not anti-war per se. His position, which he said over and over again, is he's in favor of defensive wars, and he's in favor of defense that defends America. he's just not in favor of imperialism and waging war for the benefit of Dick Cheney and the CEO of Halliburton or some other economic agenda that benefits the people who finance the politicians in Washington in their careers. For example, Ron Paul supported the invasion of Afghanistan, but not the occupation of Afghanistan, because he believed that the Taliban was supporting Al-Qaeda, which bombed us on 9/11. And so Ron has repeatedly said that he's in favor of that invasion, but not the occupation, but the subsequent occupation, which has other reasons other than defense involved. But he's not anti-war in general. He's anti-aggressive war, but he thinks just war is just war. So the Republican Party are all in the pockets of the people who benefit financially or otherwise by all these wars. And so if they want a political career, they're all basically people who have either been incapable of having a real job or no longer want a real job, like Romney, and want to be king of the world. And to be king of the world, it takes a lot of money to get there. And so they need a lot of support, a lot of financial support from Goldman Sachs and other people who benefit from the enlargement of the warfare and welfare state. And they're totally unprincipled, of course. And Ron Paul is the only one who is principled among them. So it's not surprising that none of them have switched to his position. They mouth his rhetoric from time to time, but not very often. Let's see. Lou's asking, did the North ever really get substantial financial payoff from the 50% post-Civil War tariff? Of course, the tariff rate remained in the 50% range until the income tax came in 1913. And so it wasn't the North that benefited, because if you lived in New York City or Boston and you were paying higher prices for imported for goods that had competition from abroad, you were being ripped off just as anybody who lived in Montgomery, Alabama or Atlanta, Georgia was being ripped off from those higher prices. And so it benefited the protected manufacturers who were protected to some degree from international competition, but at the expense of all consumers, North and South, and especially at the expense of farmers, because farmers in the Midwest, the upper Midwest, and the South, after the Civil War, still exported a lot of their produce. And when we engage in protectionism, as we did during and for decades after the Civil War, we impoverish our trading partners because they can't sell as much to us, and that means they can't buy as much from us. And a big portion of what they always bought from us Americans was food, agricultural products. And so farmers were always hit disproportionately hard by high tariffs. And so those post-Civil War tariffs that were in the 45% to 50% range on average for 60 years after the war were very disproportionately harmful to American farmers, but beneficial mostly to northern manufacturers who were protected to a large extent from international competition in the things they produced by those high tariffs. And so it was a major redistribution of income from consumers in general, and especially from farmers, to northern manufacturers in the post-Civil War era. And eventually a deal was cut with the farmers to get the income tax. The deal was the advocates of the income tax said, we will reduce the tariff rates if you, the farmers, politically support an income tax. And they did. And so we got the income tax. The tariff rate was dropped from the 50% range to the 20% or so range. And then within a few years, it went back up to the 30% range. And by the time you get with the 1913 income tax, then by the time you get to 1930, the Smoot-Hawley tariff raised the average tariff rate back up to 59.6%, almost 60%. And so the farmers were snookered. They said, they told them, if you go along with an income tax, we will reduce the tariff and take this unfair burden off of you. They did. Then in a few years, the farmers had an income tax and an even higher tariff rate than they had before the income tax. That's what's called bait and switch. Let's see, Tara is talking about a war with two groups of people. Well, it takes governments to really have what we think of as a war. And because, you know, like the Nazis, if it weren't for the fact that the German government had been progressively centralized, first by Otto von Bismarck and his successors, and then by Hitler, and to create a highly centralized monopolistic government that could commandeer all the resources of the country. If it weren't for that, the Nazis would have been just another gang of skinhead maniacs who would have never been able to do anything. But it was their ability to gain control of this highly centralized state, along with a central bank, that enabled them to do what they did. Yes, you'll have human conflict. There's always been human conflict. You'll have fights. You can have gangs and so forth. And that's a whole different topic. But there is actually a big literature on this, on the anarchy. And I think Bob Murphy once taught a Macy's Academy course on anarchy. But they have the type of wars we've had. And one of the points Mises makes, of course, is that along with the idea of nationalism came total war. The wars were no longer disputes between monarchs using mercenaries. All the people were involved. Once it became a matter of national pride and national survival, national prosperity, well, you as a part of the nation now, the war is your thing. It's your responsibility. It's your responsibility to fight or be drafted and pay taxes for it. Once that became the type of warfare that we had, then we had total war. We no longer had the smaller wars. We had the big world wars. And that was the difference. And, yeah, we'll always have that. We'll always have human conflict. But we won't have war without government, in my view. Let's see if there's any more Q&A here. I'm going to switch back to the Q&A. Captain Mike has been in the Bahamas too long, I guess. What role did monetary policy play in the American Revolution? Well, the government did inflate the currency. The Continental became useless because it was inflated. And there was no government bank. The war was financed, the Revolutionary War, there was no power to tax the national government at that point. The states raised taxes and the states borrowed money. Of course, there was a Fed, there was a central bank, as far as that goes, and so but they did their best to create money, but there wasn't the apparatus yet, you know, to create great inflation to finance the Revolutionary War. It was mostly taxes and debt, and they had to get the taxes out of the state governments for the most part. The Articles of Confederation did not give the federal government taxing power. It was the U.S. Constitution that first gave the U.S. government taxing power. And even then, when the Constitution was passed, there was no national bank. The first national bank was the Bank of the United States that came into being in 1791. And 1789 was the ratification of the Constitution. Weston wants to know my opinion on his war shifts from country versus country to forward to a country like Al-Qaeda, will become more like total war or limited war. I don't know. My view is that Al-Qaeda is sort of a boogeyman. Even our own CIA said there are only about 50 of them in Afghanistan, and yet we have tens of thousands of troops still there, supposedly hunting down 50 Al-Qaeda. You know, I'm not sure that bin Laden himself was not dead 10 years ago. I think the government is using the specter of Al-Qaeda to keep the military-industrial congressional complex employed, and all the defense contractors making all the money that they've been accustomed to making for generations. And I think they're using them as a boogeyman. And of course, it is our intervention in the Middle East that is the cause of that causes people to become terrorists. And that's my view of that, since you're asking. So if we would just come home and defend our own country, I think we would have no worries at all about Al-Qaeda or anybody else, because we would not be sticking our noses in their business. Let's see if there's anything in the chat here. Let me see. War of Attrition. Andrew's that's not a question. The Civil War was a war of attrition, because the Northern Army had so many more troops. If you read about some of the battles in the latter years of the American Civil War, these big Napoleonic charges with 70 or 80,000 troops on each side, that was certainly Grant knew that he had the numbers on his side, and he could afford to take many more casualties than the Southerners could, and eventually win that way. Yeah. Well, there's one question about the Bush family profiting from the war. Well, yes, I don't know. I've never seen their bank accounts as far as that is concerned. An interesting essay that's on the web on this whole issue of who makes money from war is War is a Racket by Smedley Butler. Smedley Butler was an early 20th century United States Marine. And he wrote this famous essay, War is a Racket, about how he went all over the world in the Marines pretty much to make money for different this or that corporation. And he became very jaundiced about the whole thing, very bitter. And I think he was at one point the most highly decorated military man in American history. So this is somebody who really lived it and then became an interesting writer after he got out of the Army. Yeah, Patrick, we have medal of honor winner too, Smedley Butler. I'm not sure I can answer a question to you. Total war and war of attrition. Not really an economic question. Let's see. Any more in the Q&A? Go back to the chat. Well, I'm not a total war. The type of total war that was waged in the South in the Civil War was not just using all your resources, but waging war on civilians as well as combatants. That's a little different. That's the other question about are the owners of the Federal Reserve System, who are stockholders, by the way, a modern-day mafia. No, there are a lot of people directing today's wars. The president, the secretary of state, his cabinet, all the business people, not just people who are stockholders in the Fed, are involved. You don't have to invent a conspiracy theory involving the Fed to know that there are people behind the scenes. Well, the article I put on the syllabus for next week, a very famous article, War is the Health of the State, by Randolph Warren, talks about this, talks about how all wars are really the work of probably a couple dozen people behind the scenes, business people, politicians, conniving for one reason or another. Nobody knows anything about what they're doing. They do it for years sometimes, and all of a sudden they get the country into a war, and they use the propaganda apparatus of the nation to rally the public behind it. And the public always act like sheep, and they support the president, and they support the war. And it's very easy. And Randolph Bourne talks about how the average citizen develops sort of the mindset of an infant whenever there's a war on, and will believe anything, just about anything. Will even believe that there are weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, for example. that are going to be dropped on Chicago, almost anything. And it's believed that the Iraqis were pulling the plugs from incubators of premature babies in Kuwait when they invaded Kuwait. I don't know if any of you remember that, but that was one of the lies that the Bush administration, the first Bush administration, told to justify the U.S. invasion of Iraq the first time around. And so, and people believe that stuff. And so if you spend time reading anything for next week, read very carefully the essay, War is the Health of the State by Randolph Moore, if you've never read it before. It's really great. It's not even finished. He died before he finished it, but it was published and it's on the web. Let's see, where am I here? I'm in the chat. I'm in the Q&A. People want to know the damage done by price controls worse than wartime. Well, historically in the U.S. it has been, because World War One and World War Two price controls was very pervasive, and so the more price control, the more damage. We weren't as foolish during the Vietnam War, although at the end of the Vietnam War, Nixon put price controls on as an attempt to get himself reelected. They were worried about inflation, which at the time was only 3 or 4% price inflation, and he thought there was so much concern about that, he wanted to be seen as doing something about price inflation. So he imposed more or less universal price controls. If anyway, he got reelected, he lifted the price controls on most things, but not petroleum. And so that was the cause of the energy crisis in the 70s. It was Nixon's price controls. In addition to the Arab oil embargo, Japan, which has no oil at all, had no oil shortages during the 70s because they allowed the free market pricing system to work with oil. So yeah, the price went up, but there were no shortages. Okay, let's see if I can get another one. Yeah, that's true. It was the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to the U.S. who worked for a PR firm in Washington who spread the myth about the babies, the preemies in the hospitals being murdered by the Iraqis. And of course, the lapdog media repeated this over and over again. Bob Higgins, I think one of Bob Higgins' articles that I put on the syllabus, his one on the, I think the title is The Effects of War, The Economic Effects of War During the 20th Century or something like that, gives a lot of detail about price controls during World War I and World War II. If that particular article doesn't, I will do it in class, because that's a story that should be told in a course like this, and so I'll make sure that we tell it. Let's see, we'll go back to Q&A. Let's see, how utopian would I consider the Manchester School idea that a world without trade and migration barriers would be a world without war? Well, that might have been true in their day. In their day, the 1840s, that could have been true. But today, the apparatus of war, the propaganda apparatus, Pentagon, the military-industrial congressional complex exists today that did not exist in the 1840s in England. I think would get guarantees that we'll have wars from time to time, regardless of free trade. And so their system, that statement was probably not very naive at all in 1840. But in today's world, yes, there are too many people who have too big of a personal interest in war today compared to 160, 170 years ago, a different world. And so that statement will not hold true today, but I wouldn't say it condemns them as being naive, because I think it was appropriate for their time. Any other questions? Yeah, we are going to talk about the ratchet effect. I think Mike Brewer talked about the ratchet effect. That's the theme of much of Bob Higgins, what he is most famous for, his book Crisis and Leviathan, which is not online, unfortunately, so I couldn't put chapters in the book. his several of his essays that I have put on the syllabus that are online are similar to what's in that book. But next week I'll talk about the ratchet effect of war. It's sort of like all the governments wars. The war on drugs creates a group of special interests. All the police in the country, all the schools in the country that make millions of dollars in government grants to administer the war on drugs and to teach about the war on drugs, and they use the money to pay all their salaries. They become a built-in constituency for never-ending war on drugs. And the same is true of world war in general. Who are all the principal groups who benefit from it? Well, the people who finance it certainly benefit from it. Northrop Grumman and all the other defense contractors certainly do. Politicians do. We've had a long line of presidents who have failed to improve the economy and who knew they would never be reelected, Roosevelt being one of them, unless they could get the people to rally behind them somehow, and war always does that. And so we have politicians who always know that their chances to keep their grubby, crappy jobs in Washington can be saved by a war. Look at Bill Clinton. The day that Monica Lewinsky was testifying before a grand jury, he had the military lob bombs into the Sudan because an aspirin factory there, he claimed, was a terrorist training ground. And even our own government admitted afterwards, a long time afterwards, was that, oh yes, it was an aspirin factory in Africa. But of course, that was all that the media wanted to talk about that day, was the bombing of that supposed terrorist training camp in Africa. Yes, wag the dog, that's exactly what it was. We'll talk about the groups that benefit from war in the next several weeks. Let's see, and we also have a chat here. Q&A. Phil is asking, am I aware of any comprehensive studies done on the cost of recent wars? Well, yes, Joseph Stiglitz, the left-wing economist who worked for Clinton and Obama, has written a whole book on the cost of the Iraq War. And he's written several articles in the New York Times and elsewhere on the cost of the Iraq War. And from what I've read about them, they seem pretty good. For example, you know, there are the direct costs of the Iraq War, the monetary expenditures, and then, of course, the other costs. Among the things that Stiglitz did was look at the health care costs of all the veterans who have been coming back all these years with all sorts of physical and mental ailments, which we will have to pay for the rest of their lives. And so, he apparently did an accounting of all these things. And so that's one study that I could point to. The Mises Institute published a book years ago called The Costs of War. If you want to read a general book with lots of essays about all sorts of different aspects of the cost of war, read The Costs of War, edited by John Denson and published by the Mises Institute. I think it's online. I'm not exactly sure. So I know some of the essays are online. I've made it online, but maybe not every one of them. And it includes essays like the one by Joe Salerno that's on our syllabus for this class, on inflation and war. There are also several essays by World War II veterans on what it was like to actually be in the Marines in World War II in terms of the cost of war to someone who was in that situation. And so so I highly recommend that book. But I know in terms of recent studies, I would look at his. Any more questions? We don't have to continue answering questions. We're running out of time anyway. Well, I'm sort of running out of gas here. Maybe we'll call it a night then. I have 8:55 on my watch here. And I don't see any more questions. But thanks a lot for signing up, taking the course. I hope you you learn a lot. I've mentioned several books. Yeah, Tara says, The Cost of War would be a good book, and Crisis and Leviathan by Robert Higgs, must read. if you're interested in the material in this class. Those are the two books I would recommend, The Cost of War and Crisis and Leviathan. And so have a good night. See you next week. And we'll talk about war and the growth of the state next week. It'll be the most fun class, I think.